friend of mine, Sidney Lee, who was the headman of the Yukon River, Annan, the last of the nomadic people in Southeast Asia. And the rains that had pounded the forest all day had let up, and we sat by a fire and coals roasted the head of a sandbar deer. And suddenly, Asif looked up to the moon, through the canopy, and he looked to me and he said, "Is it true your people have been there?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, what kind of canoe and transport did you have? Why did you go? Is it true you only brought back rock and dust?" Well, it was hard to explain to a man who kindled fire with flint, a space program that consumed the wealth of nations, and in fact had catapulted a series of astronauts several billion miles from space, and they only brought back rock and dust, 828 pounds of it altogether. But of course, his question provoked a timeless answer. We didn't go to the moon for new wealth, but to acquire a new vision of life itself. And a seminal moment famously happened on Christmas Eve of 1968 when Apollo 8 went around the dark side of the moon and emerged in the darkness to see for the first time in the human experience not a sunrise or a moonrise, but a Earthrise. In that crystal moment of awareness, everything changed. We realized that we were not a finite, infinite frontier. We were, in fact, a finite planet, as the astronauts famously put it, floating in the velvet void of space. And if you think about it, we almost immediately began to think in new ways. Just think about it. 30 years ago, just getting people to stop throwing garbage out of the car loop was considered a great environmental victory. Nobody spoke about the biosphere. Now those terms are part of the vocabulary of school children. Rachel Carson was a lone voice in the wild. A good friend of mine, a hero of mine, Gary Snyder, one of the poets of deep ecology, once told me that in the 1950s he would hitchhike across America just to have dinner with someone to whom he could relate. And like this great wave of hope, this energy of illumination really has swept through history. Just think about it. In one generation, women have gone from the kitchen to the boardroom, people of color from the woodshed to the White House, gay people from the closet to the altar. What's not to love about a world and a country where such cultural innovations can happen in the wake of the revelations and the brilliance of science? But of course, you're here because we still have a very long way to go. And the story, as Rachel suggested, that I want to share with you today is not a story of the Amazon or of the Syrian sands of the Sahara. I won't be taking you to Peru or to the ceremonies of West Africa. I'm taking you to a place very close to my own backyard. As she suggested, a place known to all the First Nations as the sacred headwaters. A place where in a long day, perhaps two, you can follow the tracks of the grizzly and wolf and drink from the very headwaters that gave rise to the great salmon rivers of home, the Sikkim, the Skeena, and the Mass. It's also a story of landscape and memory, the fluidity of our memory and our haunting capacity both to forget and to adapt. I mean, how many of us, for example, recall that in the lifetime of our great grandparents, pasture pigeons made up 40% of birds in North America. Audubon described flocks of 2 to 3 billion birds blackening skies over Cincinnati. From the height of their population to their final extinction was a generation. Pigeon meat was a mainstay of the American diet, and those who could afford to shoot their birds for sport would catapult 50,000 live birds to their death in a single day until the mission supplies forced us in skeet shooting to turn to clay pigeons. In fact, the term stool pigeon we have in English was a killing technique in the era. You caught a bird, sewed his eyelids shut, tied its legs to a pole, and its cries would bring the flocks in such abundance that it could be gathered out of the sky. Well, how many of us remember the time the buffalo outnumbered people in North America? As late as 1871, you could stand on a bluff anywhere in the Dakotas and see herds with grazing areas the size of Rhode Island passing by over the prairie. And again, from the height of their population to their reduction to a zoological curiosity, it did not take a century, as sort of the standard story goes, as a consequence of the inexorable progression of the American frontier. That actually occurred over about 7 years as explicit policy of the U.S. cavalry to destroy the commissary of the Great Plains cultures. And when the last of the buffalo was the shadow of the prairie, and the last of the great chiefs was reduced to the reservations, Philip Sheridan, The Civil War general who orchestrated the campaign recommended to the U.S. Congress that a commemorative medal be minted that would have on one side of it a dead buffalo and on the other side a dead Indian. How many of us realize that in the time of our grandfathers, these seeds right off of Seattle ran golden with the return of the salmon? How many of us can imagine a time when early European explorers over the Grand Banks with a full head of sail had their ships locked by the sheer density of cod in the waters off of Newfoundland? How many of us can imagine a time when the Grand Canyon was not visited by 5 million people every year, when 27,000 people did not float it every summer, when its flow was not controlled by technicians at one of the 11 dams, when it actually reached the sea, as opposed to now, when it merely is a shadow of the sand in its delta, a river only in name, a toxic trickle that slips into the Gulf of California? You know, when John Muir visited Yosemite in 1868, found himself to be alone. Today, the equivalent of the entire population of Los Angeles visits that national park every year, and on the valley bottom, there are over 4,000 people cited each year for breaking the law, believe it or not, there's 600 car accidents in the Yosemite Valley. And how often do we think, you know, would it be incredible if we could go back in time and see Turtle Island as it was in those early, early years? Well, the wonderful thing is that you can. All you have to do is go to Canada. The remote country I'm going to take you to was visited by John Muir in 1879. He went up the lower reaches of the Saskatchewan River alone. He crawled the Yosemite 120 miles long, and he went back to California, and he named his dog Stikine after that beloved river of his enchantment. And if you went on to the lower Stikine today, you would find fewer visitors than the era of John Muir. It's the kind of country where we as Canadians could throw England and the English would never find it. In the lower 48 of the United States, the far farthest you can get away from the main chain road is 20 miles. In the northwest quadrant of British Columbia, an area south of the state of Oregon, there's one road, the narrow ribbon of tarmac that slips up the side of the Coast Mountains to the Yukon. Well, Muir never got that far up the Stikine. He saw the great glaciers, he counted 300 on his way up, climbed Lodora Peak, looked west, saw another 300. But he never got beyond the lower reaches. He never got to its eyes, the sacred mountain, the Taltan, where a guy once told me, when I asked him how long it took to cross the lava flow, he said a pair of boots. Obsidian seemed to the Taltan people as a living being. You could not approach it in pre-contact times without having some kind of ritual engagement. Often 6 months of fasting and preparation. On the back side of it, you come upon acres of even miles of obsidian, what the Taltan called the black blood of the mountain, volcanic glass that was traded south as far as Shasta, east across the Rocky Mountains, and west as far as Haida Gwaii. He never saw the kaleidoscopic specter of mountains, also sacred to the Taltan, where it seems that God himself and speckled the landscape with a kind of a cosmic array of watercolors. And he never got into the Grand Canyon of the Stikine, Canada's biggest canyon, known to world-class kayakers as the K2 of whitewater challenges, whereas you have 27,000 people float your Grand Canyon every year, in all of history, less than 100 world-class kayakers have made it through this 90-kilometer chute of formidable water. And the canyon itself is decorated by an endemic population of goat who, in contrast to their natural habit, which is to go up to escape predation, here they go down to the very belly of the earth in huge numbers and concentrations on these great sedimentary and basaltic cliffs 1,600 feet high. And had he gone up and followed out of the mouth of the canyon into the hinterland, following the routes to the interior, he would have come to the most beautiful place of all, the sacred headwaters, birthplace of these three great rivers. But each one of those rivers themselves resonate with cultural significance, because along each one was founded a civilization, the Taltan, the Clinton on the Stikine, the Mishka on the Nass, and of course the Itzan Wet'suwet'en, the Carrier, the Haisla, and sometimes the Haida on the Skeena, because the waters of the the scheme of great abundance to hide why. Well, I followed that narrow ribbon of road up to the Stikine country in the mid-1970s to become the first park ranger in the Spatsizi Wilderness, which is our largest roadless wilderness park in British Columbia. And my job description was deliciously vague: wilderness assessment and public relations. In 2 4-month seasons, I saw 12 people, so there was no one to relate publicly to. And wilderness assessment was licensed to ramble. In the course of my wanderings, I came upon an old native grave at the headwaters of the Stikine. Carved in wood, it simply said, "Love, old man Antoine, died in 1926. And curious as to the origin of that grave, I traveled across the lake to a spike camp of a hunting outfitter who became a good friend of mine, because I knew in his camp was working a legendary native leader, Alexak. He did sound by birth, whose native name, Akahena, and he who walks in leaving no tracks. And I asked Alec about the origin of that grave, and he said, "Oh, you find that thing. I put her there a long time ago, forget where she'd be." But it turns out Alex had followed the interior trading routes in the wake of the legendary outlaw Simon Gundu to the Grandpa country with his father in the early years of the 20th century. He'd arrived as his future son, brother-in-law, Antoine Louis, was literally laying Antoine to rest. It turned out that Antoine was a legendary shaman, crippled by birth, who was able to divine the future by reading the waves created by stones dropped into pockets woven in spruce roots. And it's really by this link between a living elder with whom I communicate and a shaman from pre-Columbian times, I quit my job as a park ranger and I hired on to work it out. Now, one of the things we always forget about where we live, the sail of sea, is how recently it was reached by Europeans. So we look in the Panama Canal, this was about as far from Europe as we could get. So at the time when Montreal was entering the third century, when the Amazon had been commercialized for 400 years, First Nations along this coast had yet to encounter Europeans. And the first sustained contact with the Tahltan did not really happen for the first decades of the 19th century. So Alec, although he did have seasonal contact with the Hudson Bay for traders at places like Fort Ware, Fort Common, and Bear Lake, Telegraph Creek, he really didn't understand the engagement of the European world until he was 43 years old. He never attended the residential schools. His soul was not crushed by the black robes. And I asked him, nevertheless, for several months to tell me the stories of the land and so on. And he always would say, "Oh, can't remember nothing, long time ago." And then one day, one of our hunters killed the moose late in the day and took the trophy and abandoned the meat. The next day, I put my canoe on the float of our plane, dropped it in the kill site, chased away a bunch of wolves, and salvaged the entire carcass, which was 2,000 pounds of meat. I even brought down the cape. I don't know why, I just did. And I had this canoe filled to the gunwales with moose meat. I arrived a couple days later. I'd just been sleeping in stones. I was drenched in dry moose blood. And for some reason I never quite understood, Alex anticipated my return. And as I got to the dock of our camp, there he was with a horse and a sled, ready to haul his meat to the smokehouse to cure it. And as we crossed the prairie, he suddenly turned to me and said, "Oh, I don't know. Funny thing, I kind of remember sort of come by my place tonight." And that night, as liquor was settling of a kerosene lamp with rain falling on the canvas, I began to record what would end up being 35 years of mythological tales of Wicket, the trickster transformer of Gitsan Lore, an anthropomorphic figure of folly, of rage and coyote, who in his vanity and his folly teaches the people how to live. And all of these stories were stories of moral rectitude played out landscape. And I remember I asked Alec at one point in time how long the cycle of tales was, and it was always so interesting to listen to Alec speak, because of course he spoke seven languages. His grandmother was Cree, he had married Madeline, who spoke Secondi, he had picked up Tahltan from the Tahltan, Kaskadini from the people of the northwest of his territory, and his grandmother, I said, was Cree. His mother and carrier. And of course, he learned English from the priests. And so the care that one uses when speaking a foreign language, he chose his words carefully. He would never say, for example, a hunter must never hurt an animal, because of course a hunter, by definition, must kill the thing he loves most, the animals upon which he lives. But what he would say is one must never suffer an animal, because suffer was something altogether different. Suffering implied shame, disgrace, pain, sorrow, humiliation. These were the things that should never be inflicted on an animal. And I asked him how long this cycle of tales was. He said to find out, it was a good question, he and his father put on snowshoes and marched on a town of good ice, and began to walk from one end of Bear Lake to the other, as he put it, telling the story as they went along. And as he finally said, all the way there, all the way back, story not halfway done. But the marvelous metaphor was to measure the duration of the sacred tale. It wasn't enough to set a timepiece. You had to move through sacred geography, telling the story as you went along. He told me the story of when the black ropes tried to evangelize his father. And his father was kind of an open-minded man, so he said to the priest, well, this place you call it heaven, what's it like? Well, it's all white. Everybody's got wings. Everybody gets along. Yeah, but what kind of animal you got up there? Well, there's no animals in it. Wait, there's no caribou. What's a wolf going to eat? Wait a minute. There's no wolf, no caribou? Moose got to be doing pretty good. And suddenly, the mom asked his father that heaven was a place where the white guys didn't allow animals. He turned to him and said, you got to be fucking mine. I can't drink, swear, mess around with my woman, do all the things that make life worth living. You go to a place where you don't like animals, you can simply forget about it. So through Alec, I met so many wonderful elders whose souls, as I said, hadn't been crushed in the residential schools. And after a while, I bought fish camp at a place called Yanui Lake, the Skyfish Lake. And we named it Wolf Creek after a story that Alex told when he and Charlie Abu, who was his protege, had been traveling back in the interior again in the spring, in time of good ice. And they had come right by the bay of this little camp when suddenly Alex found himself surrounded by a group of menacing wolves. He reached for his rifle and his scabbard and found that the scabbard was in fact empty. He had lent his beloved 30-06 to Charlie Lou, who was a mile back down the lake. And as the wolves kind of came in on his dogs, Alec didn't know what he was going to do, and then suddenly one of the wolves fell over dead in the snow. And then another one fell over dead. Before he knew it, he was surrounded by a semicircle of dark, dead humps on the ice. And from a distance of muffled rifle fire, Charlie picked them off one by one, saving the dogs and the life of his dear friend and mentor, Alec Jack. Well, Alec lived to be 92. His wife, Madeline, was 105 when she died, the oldest native person at the time in British Columbia. At that point, she was bedridden and blind. And I remember every year when we returned to the country, she would read the faces of my daughters like braille to see how much they've grown over the intervening months. And Alec used to always say, it's a good thing you take your kids snow, the kids get bigger than that. And when faced by their progress, she reached into a candy jar and gave them candies and so on. And I remember one day when, after she had passed away, my daughter and I were with Alec painting a picket fence around her grave, and suddenly Charlotte, who was remarkable, hunter and protege of Alec, who himself at that time was said to be crippled, in this sort of sheer act of will, crawled up this steep escarpment to the graveyard overlooking the village, even as a tempest of storm seemed to sweep up the valley, and suddenly the sky darkened. And it was an extraordinary moment because I had a strong sense that I was in the presence of a true raven. Charlie always, trickster, coyote, and raven rolled into one. Alex grounded like a bear. Nothing was said between them, but I had very much a sense that I was in the presence of greatness, knowing full well that even man was long for this world. And just before Alice died, at the age of 96, he gave me a final gift, and it was a tool that he carved from his grandfather in 1910, the caribou bone, was kind of stained with decades of human touch. So the tip of it was a spatula tip, serrated. And I, of course, had no idea what it was for. It turned out to be a specialized tool used by a hunter to skin out the eyelids of wolves. And it was only after Alice died that I realized that in some sense the eyelids in question were my own. Having done so much to allow me to see in that country for so many years, old man Al in his own way was saying goodbye. Well, isolation has been the saving grace of this country, but now isolation, I'm afraid, could be its doom. Over the years, we who lived there, the handful of us, 1,200 people in a valley the size of Switzerland, have observed any number of mega-development projects sweep over the country, plans to dam the Grand Canyon Stikine, plans to quadruple the annual allowable cut in the border of rural forests, a $1 billion railroad to nowhere built in the early 1970s. All of these projects have kind of collapsed under the weight of their own stupidity. But in the 1990s, everything changed. This is the royal growth of Asian markets. Gold went up to $1,800 an ounce, copper increasing eightfold. There has become almost a tsunami of economic development in this country. You hear in the States so much about the tar sands, Keystone, the Enbridge pipeline. These are just elements of a tsunami that has left as many as 41 industrial proposals on the desk of my good friend Marie Kwok, chief in the community of Iskut. Some of these projects have great promise, some, of course, are great concern. On Taudian Mountain, a wildlife sanctuary in the sky, home to the largest resident population of stone sheep in the world, a population that attracts incredible concentrations of grizzly and wolverine and black bear, and of course wolves, Imperial Metal, but the 75th largest mining company in Canada, has secured permission and is building an open pit copper and gold mine, which process something on the order of a minimum 30,000 tons of rock a day, possibly as much as 150,000 tons of rock a day for 30 years. By the project's design, that rock will be dumped in the Alpine Lakes to form the headwaters of the Iskut, the main affluent of the Stikine. There are 4,000 copper and gold mines in the world. To put one on top of Taudigan is like drilling for oil in the Sistine Chapel. And the extraordinary thing about this is that the program and the plans flew through the environmental assessment process. Even by project design, it would dismantle this iconic mountain, a mountain where the wildlife values are so superb that for 40 years the government has not allowed anyone to hunt on it with a rifle. It's one of these incredible centers of wildlife importance in British Columbia. And by project design, of course, the mine will inundate the headwaters of the Iskut River, a series of nine lakes, each more beautiful than the next, which surround the incredible mountain. The mountain looks west to the sacred mountain, its eyes are east to Spatsizi, in the heartland of what has to be the most beautiful place in Canada. Here's one of the lakes, Yalui, where we live. It flows into Tatoga. From the other side of the mountain, the black jewel of a lake called Black Lake. All of this valley and this photograph will be inundated with toxic tailings which will flow in three different directions, one of which will carry them into Cluia Lake, Taudigan Lake, and from there down into Tatoga, eventually Kinistan, Natadeslin, over Cascade Falls, and the Iskut River, which of course meets the Stikine, not far from the American border. The headwaters itself, Royal Dutch Shell, did have plans to extract coal bed methane gas from a tenure of a million acres. Fortunately, in their wisdom, and they deserve an enormous amount of credit, they have pulled out of this project, committed to the idea that the Tahltan people have to be respected, and that landscape need not be violated. And yet, unfortunately, our provincial government, having burnished its environmental credentials with that act, of Shell, meanwhile, was fast-tracking a small Ontario-based coal company in that very same tenure where they have a proposal to build an open-pit anthracite mine of gargantuan scale right at the heart of the sacred headwaters. This beautiful pond, the If you drop a leaf into it, the wind blows it one way, it will end up going down Skeena to Prince Rupert in the highest sea. If the wind goes the other way, it will enter the Stikine and end up at Wrangell, Alaska. And, you know, what I think is interesting about these projects is environmental considerations aside, think of what they tell us about our culture. You know, what does it take to get a mine established in this resource-based economy? We basically cobble together a company with less history than my dog. You get online and secure the subsurface rights to a place you've never been, the stories you've never heard, the pain of a long winter you've never experienced. And as long as you can guarantee a government the flow of revenue, either in the form of royalties or taxation, you secure the right, by definition, to transform that valley for all time. But what's fascinating is that there's not a single metric in your calculus that rationalizes the industrialization of the wild that attempts to put any monetary value whatsoever on the land as it was, or conversely, any cost to the commons, the rest of us who are not invested in the enterprise, inherent in the transformation of that landscape. Now, we take that for granted because of the way we industrialize landscape in a resource-driven economy. Viewed through the anthropological lens, it's very strange behavior. You know, like all cultures, we tend to be ethnocentric, culturally myopic, faithful to our own interpretations of reality. So we tend to think that we and our values exist somehow outside of history and culture, and of course, by definition, they're products of both. And in our particular tradition, going back to the Renaissance, when we attempted to liberate the individual from the tyranny of absolute faith, we liberated the individual from the collective, which is the sociological equivalent of splitting the atom. And in the Enlightenment, when Descartes famously said that all that existed was mind, matter, and mechanism, in a single gesture, in a sense, he deanimated the entire world, leaving the only sentient creature respect to be ourselves. And in time, as Saul Bellow said, science made a host-claiming of belief. And in that sense, we sort of embraced a kind of philosophical materialism in which only phenomena could be measured by the senses could exist. So all notions of myth, magic, mysticism, and even metaphor were swept out the door. But those were both the very nuanced intuitions that allowed people sense out of sensation, find order and meaning in the universe that they have done, and have also critically created reciprocal and dynamic relationships between human beings and the natural world itself. Now, what do I mean by that? I was raised in British Columbia to believe our forests existed to be cut. That was the foundation of the ideology of scientific forestry that I learned in school and I practiced as a logger in the middle of the Belvin Woods. That made me profoundly different from my friends amongst the Kwakwaka, who believed those same forests were devoid of hookah and crooked eager heaven and the countless spirits that have to be embraced during the initiation rite of the Hamasah, such as the wisdom of the wild coming back to the community and the potlatch. Now, the interesting thing is not to say who's right and who's wrong. Is it the cellulose and board feet? Is it the domain of the spirits? That's not the interesting question. The interesting question is how the belief system mediates the relationship between inhuman culture and its landscape with profoundly different consequences for the ecological footprint. My godchildren in Peru believe that the mountains that soar above their villages are happy deities that will direct their destiny. That gives them a different relationship to landscape than my children, raised in my culture, believe that the mountain is simply a pile of rock ready to be mined. And that's the essence of the relationship between indigenous people and landscape. They're not self-conscious of their own place in the landscape. They're not so large in some Rousseauian sense. On the contrary, they have, through time and ritual, created a traditional mystique of the earth that's based not on sentiment or nostalgia. There's no place for either in the Syrian sands of the Sahara, the harsh winds of the Arctic, but a relationship that's based on the subtle idea that the earth itself only exists because it's built into imagination. And as a result of that, mountains and rivers and forests are not perceived as being inanimate, as mere props upon which the human stage and drama unfolds. For these societies, in some deep sense, the land really is alive, a dynamic force to be embraced and transformed by human imagination. And that's where we, in some sense, perhaps went wrong. And this sense of who owns the land is another vital issue. You know, one of the things I find in Northern British Columbia so disturbing is that Canadians love the idea of the North, but none of us go there. I interviewed our premier, a man I admired, Premier Campbell, and not only in his two terms of office, but his entire life, he had never visited a quarter of the province. Can you imagine a governor of Washington State had never been to Yakima? Well, this is what happens in Canada. I was in Mike Jones's lodge thinking of my friend. Mike died on his trap line, and the Mounties couldn't get in for 6 months because of the accumulation of snow. 9 feet of snow fell on that valley. In fact, I wrote about the Roadside magazine. The editor in Chicago refused to believe me. They changed it to inches. Went back to feet, inches to feet. And finally, I got an affidavit from the Mountie saying it was feet, but the American Mountie still insisted on inches, but it wasn't back. I was thinking of Mike, and there was a stranger in the corner having a cup of tea. And this woman walked in, and clearly had come from the Red Brick mindset. She was an engineer. Now, I used to be an engineer. You can always tell us. Fluorescent vest, hard hats, steel toe boots. Now they all look like they come out of a bloody Patagonian catalog. But I took the dynamic. This was their conversation. I swear, I'm quoting. Sort of quote. Wow. Did you? I've never seen so many sheep. Did you see sheep? I counted 35 wolves. I've never seen a wolf before. Did you see a grizzly bear? I think it was the most beautiful place I've ever seen. Ever been up here? No. I got to Williams Lake once. What about you? Well, I made it to Prince George. What? So here they were, Deputy Minister of Mines, head engineer at Red Chris, couldn't stop breathlessly praising this land that was their bureaucratic and corporate mission to destroy. And I thought maybe the irony would fall to them and they would simply take their schemes and their own selves out of that valley. Well, of course, they didn't. And for more than a decade, the Tahltan people, both clans, Wolf and Crow, actively resisted these assaults on their homeland, men, women, and children, old and young. Even elders in wheelchairs that stood up in the rain and snow, blockading the roads to the interior. For them, the interior is not a wilderness, it's a neighborhood. It's a neighborhood where caribou outnumber people, but nevertheless a neighborhood where, through the generations, men and women have come to terms with the natural world. Those terms demand the luxury of space. My closest friend is a man called Oscar Dennis. And this is a photograph of Oscar that appeared in the National Geographic magazine. I must say that when this appeared, women from all around the world made a beeline for his skin. It's a true story. Call me as a waitress. This chick from Portland come to see me. So, it's not the most ridiculous scene. You just had someone from Moscow there last week. And he said, I know. And we don't speak Russian or Polish. You know, they don't really come to for conversation. One of the issues on this whole mining thing is how many mines. We're not against mines. There's not a single environmental group involved in this struggle. It's all local people, native people, non-native people, outfitters, poets, filmmakers, hunters, etc., fishers. And I showed this photograph of Peter Campbell, Mission Boston County. There's not about mines or no mines. How many mines in what place, at what pace, at what harm to the environment, and critically for whose benefit. I said to Mr. Campbell, Premier Campbell, I said, Mr. Premier, in the 5 years before this photograph was taken, Oscar's brother hung himself in the basement of his mother's house. His other brother drowned 10 feet from shore. Third brother died of medical malpractice in Prince Rupert. A sister died on the streets of Prince George from prostitution. Oscar's own daughter, Dorel, and Russian roulette in a drug deal in Terrace. And I said, in those 5 years, Barrick Gold, from another mine in their territory, had taken in 400 tons of gold, 5,000 tons of silver, a today's market valuation, $25 billion. And I said to the Premier of British Columbia, I'd like to know why there's not a hockey rink in this city. I'd like to know why there's not a swimming pool in this city. Why is there trust funds for every kid to go to college, trust funds for new, small, sustainable businesses to come up, elder centers, so the elders are not alone in the daytime and at night. And the Premier really had no answer to that question. So this is really the question. And Oscar's mother, Mary, once said to me that the real measure these days of a Tahltan was not the color of skin or blood, but the manner in which one treated the land. And And I think what she meant to say, she told me that at a lake she buried one of her boys. I think what she meant to say is that we all have a chance to be tall, and not by co-opting the ethnicity of the so uniquely and powerfully theirs, but simply by expressing in spirit a commitment, a loyalty to place. When I first lived in this Bikini, there was a gathering of Iskut in opposition to the proposals of BC Hydro to dam the Grand Canyon of the Stikine. And a young hippie back to the lander stood up a lad, and what he thought was a gesture of solidarity, he said to the assembly, "You know, if they build these dams, I'm just going to have to leave this country." And right after him, a young Tahltan youth stood up with immense dignity and said, "You know, partner, that's the difference between me and you. If they build these dams, I'm still going to be here." When I once asked Gary Snyder what was the most important thing we could do for the environment, Gary said, "Stay put." And the moment that I knew that the Iskut Valley would always create a my family occurred on a night in 2010 when my youngest daughter disappeared at the lake at Dalui. She's a very special girl with a very special connection to that land. She once had a near terminal disease that was in a sense healed by a return to that place. When she was a little 5-year-old girl, she disappeared from the lodge, and the country was just thick with bears. And so I worried about her. I looked everywhere. I finally found her a mile and a half up the creek after about 7 hours of searching. She had a little purple bond on, and she'd come down and get some work gloves, and she was kneeling over a dead black bear cub trying to stroke it back to life. And I looked around for the boar that had obviously killed the cub and threatened my daughter, saw nothing, and took this little cub and put it beneath the cleft of rock on a bed of moss. I took my little girl by the hand, and we walked down, and when we got to the lodge, old man Alec was waiting for us, and he heard about that bear, and he took it as a sign. What, I was never really sure, but after asking people, always had an idea that you can have 10 kids, and some of us would have none, but give a couple of your kids to be raised, because it's the strength of the community that matters, not the nuclear family. But there's always an idea that one who stays by you. And Alec used to always say to Raina, "She is the one who must stay by you." And that night, Raina went out of the lake, and I knew I had, the week before some world-class kayakers had fallen in the lake and had fished out of it at the hypothermia. So worried about Raina, I took out the skiff and I went to where I knew she'd be. Her favorite spot on the lake is the promontory that rises at the end of the game trail about 150 feet above the lake and gives a stunning view of our lodge where she was born, nestled between the arms of Sky Mountain. And so approached in the darkness, I could hear that she'd been sobbing, crying her eyes out. And when I got to her and I asked the obvious question as a father, she just turned to me and she said, "Daddy," this is a quote, "Daddy, this is my only home. This has been the vortex of my life. It's so beautiful. This is where I want to live and where I want to die." And it was in that moment, even as the engineers and miners at Red Chris, about 5 kilometers where we sat from where we sat in the woods, went about their business of dismantling Taudia Mountain, I promised Raina that no matter what happened, we would never leave that lake. We would never abandon our Tahltan friends. And even if I wasn't alive in 30 years' time to hear and experience the return of silence to the lake, she would be, and children would be. And that's exactly what the Tahltan people have been teaching me all along. Of course, none of this has to happen. Egregious projects can be reversed. Even should the debate come down to economics, it makes no sense to violate a landscape like this. The travel business in British Columbia today employs more people than mining, commercial fishing, and logging put together. It's a $4.5 trillion international business. The total capitalization of every mining company in the world does not add up to $1 trillion. And so the plight of the sacred headwaters really is a question not just for the region or for Canada, but for all of us. These projects will only go ahead if we accept that people who have never been on the land, who have no history of connection to the place, can legally secure the right to come in by the very nature of their enterprises, the landscape violated and transformed. They will go ahead if we continue to endorse the process that grants mining concessions, trivial amounts of money to speculators from distant cities, even as we put no cultural or market value in the land itself. They'll go ahead and maintain the cost of destroying a natural asset where its inherent worth is left intact need not be part of the calculus of economic planning. They will go ahead and maintain the idea that no private company has to compensate the commons for what it does for lands and places that belong to everyone. And they will go ahead, as long as we continue to embrace the mindset that has no place in a world in which lands like this are becoming increasingly wild, even as we are all coming to understand that the earth itself is resilient but not inviolable. The elders have stood up for a decade now in defense of this land. The fate of the headwaters transcends their interest, our interest, the interest of the province of British Columbia, of Canada, of North America. This is a place that really could be not just the sacred headwaters of the Tahltan people and of all the First Nations of British Columbia. This is a landscape that is waiting to be the sacred headwaters of all peoples of the world. Thanks very much.